This morning, as the infection turned toward fever, every now and then Johnny would say, "Oh my God, those feet." There were about 14 people in the igloo, although he feels that they could have been sitting on a few old ladies. They had slipped out of their clothing, and the ripeness of all of them hit him like a stone axe, and he says he keeled over, although he didn't pass out. He said they immediately offered him 3 different people, whom he decided must have been women, and some of the fellows there even seemed ready to lift him on. Although he discovered that it was impossible to get used to the congress of smells, he was able to concentrate on them just being women, and all other considerations in that tiny space actually left his mind. He said it was no question of poontang next year with a girl who smelled like flowers. It was a case of poontang now, and he began to get out of his clothes. He was actually getting undressed in front of all those people, and he said he would pause every now and then to give the nearest shape that he assumed was a girl a little pinch or a tiny tickle, when all of a sudden one of the Eskimos started to yell at him in German. Johnny said he doesn't speak German, but he knows it when he hears it because they speak a lot of it in his home state. Then this Eskimo began to take off his furs in that way a man takes off his coat when he wants to start a fight, yelling all the time in German and pointing at the Eskimo woman Johnny had been diddling and who was now giggling up at Johnny. When Johnny sees that this man is wearing a German officer's uniform under the skins. As this was the first time Johnny had ever believed that there was any enemy, he said he was absolutely flabbergasted. The Eskimos in the igloo began to yell at the German to shut up, or maybe they felt that he had impugned their hospitality by interrupting Johnny, or maybe they were sore because they liked to watch. And by now the woman had reached up, and she had Johnny firmly by the privates, and she wasn't letting go, because for whatever crazy reason, she liked Johnny. The noise bounced back and forth from ice wall to ice wall. Dogs started barking, kids started crying. The German was yelling and weeping through what was obviously a broken heart, and Johnny said he felt very embarrassed. He realized he had been making a pass at this guy's girl right in front of the guy himself, which must have hurt him terribly, and it wasn't right, even if he was the enemy. Johnny felt. He didn't know what to do, so he hit the man, and as the man fell, he knocked 4 of the small Eskimos over with him. This turned the tables. The other Eskimos now got sore at Johnny, and 3 of them rushed him, waving what Johnny calls Stone Age power tools. He swept his arms out in front of him and sent the attackers over backward into the mob. All of this happening, he said, inside an area about as big as Orson Welles' head, with everybody howling for blood. He decided then that he wasn't going to score after all, and that he'd better get the hell out of there. So he tried to dive through the tunnel, which led to the full-force Arctic hurricane outside, forgetting entirely that the Eskimo woman had him by the family jewels, and she had decided to keep those jewels for her very own. Johnny says he never felt anything quite like what he felt then, and that he thought he had actually lost his reason for living. Rejecting her both physically and psychologically, he let fly with his left foot, catching her smartly in the face. She sank her overdeveloped teeth into his foot, then she crunched down again, then settled down to a steady munching, and he says if it hadn't been for her getting hit by someone in that yelling, milling throng behind her in the igloo, she might have chewed his foot off. How he got back here in that weather with that foot, I will never know. The wound had festered badly by this morning. They took him out of here for Etah about an hour ago. I guess that's the end of the war for old Johnny. In August 1944, Johnny came limping home to take up his part in the red-hot campaign that friends, meaning Raymond's mother, and to a conclusive extent, even though it seems absolutely impossible in retrospect, the Communist Party had been carrying forward since the day he had gone off to war. All Johnny had to do was wear his uniform, his crutches, and his bandaged foot, and shout out a few 100 topical exaggerations that Raymond's mother had written up and cataloged over the years to evade any conceivable demand. Because of the clear call from the people of his state, Johnny was permitted to resign from the armed forces on August 11, 1944. He was elected governor of his state in the elections of 1944 and re-elected in 1948. As he entered his second term, he was 41 years old. Raymond's mother was 38. Raymond was 21 and was working as a district man for the Journal, having graduated from the state university at the head of his class. At 41, Governor Iselin was a plain, aggressively humble man, 5 feet 8 inches tall in specially shod elevator shoes. There was a fleshiness of the nose to mark him for the memory. His hair was thin and, under certain lighting, appeared to have been painted in fine single lines across his scalp, over rosettes and cabbages of two-dimensional liver spots. His clothes, from a time shortly after his marriage to Raymond's mother, were of homespun material, but they had been run up by the hands of a terribly good and quite wealthy tailor in New York. Raymond's mother had Johnny's valet shine only the lower half of his high black shoes, so that it would seem to people who thought about those things that he managed to shine his own shoes between visits of the strawberry lobby and the refusal of pardons to the condemned. An abiding mark of the degree of Johnny's elemental friendliness shone from the fact that he could look no one in the eye, and that when he talked he would switch syntax in seeming horror of what he had almost said to his listener. The governor never shaved from Friday night to Monday morning, no matter what function might be scheduled, as though he were a part-time Sikh. He would explain that this gave his skin a rest. Raymond's mother had invented that one, as she had invented very nearly everything else about him, excepting his digestive system. And if she had invented that, it would have functioned a great deal better. Because not shaving made him like some slob, like a farmhand or some hunky factory worker. It is certain that over a weekend, when Big John was generating noise out of every body orifice, switching syntax, darting his eyes about, and flashing that meaty nose in his unshaven face, he was the commonest kind of common man 40 ways to the ace. However, he had been custom-made by Raymond's mother. She had developed Johnny as José Raúl Capablanca had developed his chess play, as Marie-Antoine Carême had folded herbs into a sauce for Talleyrand, into the model governor, on paper that is, of all the states of the United States. And in some of those other states, the constituents read more about Jolly Johnny than about their own men. She had riveted into the public memory these immutable facts. John Yerkes Iselin was a formidable administrator, a conserver who could dare, an honest, courageous, conscience-thrilled, God-fearing public servant, a jolly, jovial, generous, gentling, humorous, amiable, good-natured, witty big brother, a wow of a husband and a true blue pal of a father, a fussin' fumin' fightin' soldier boy, all heart, a simple country judge with the savvy of Solomon, and an American, which was the most fortuitous circumstance of all. Raymond's mother hardly showed one flicker of chagrin when General Eisenhower was persuaded to make the stroll for the nomination in 1952, the one unexpected accident that could have blocked her John from the White House. She broke a few little things at the mansion when she heard the news, mirrors, lamps, vases, and other replaceable bric-a-brac. She was entitled to a flash of violence, one little demonstration that she could feel passion, and it harmed no one because Johnny was dead drunk, and Raymond had marched off to the Korean War. In the autumn of 1952, 2 weeks before Raymond's return from Korea to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor, almost 2 months before the end of Big John's statutory final term as governor, U.S. Senator Ole Bansdofsen, the grand old man who had represented his state in Washington for 6 consecutive terms, succumbed to a heart attack almost immediately after a small dinner with his oldest and dearest friends, Governor and Mrs. John Iselin, and died in the governor's arms in the manner of a dinner guest of the Empress Livia's sometime before in ancient Rome. The exchange of last words made their bid to become part of American history, for through them Big John found his life's mission, and the words are set down herewith to complete the record. Senator Bansdofsen.
John, Johnny boy, are you there?
Governor Iselin.
Ole, old friend, don't try to speak. Eleanor, where is that doctor?
Senator Bansdofsen, his last words.
Johnny, you must carry on. Please, please, Johnny, swear to me as I lay dying that you will fight to save our country from the communist peril.
Governor Iselin, greatly moved.
I pledge to you with my soul that I will fight to keep communists from dominating our institutions to the last breath of my life, dear friend.
Senator Bansdofsen slumps into death, made happy. Governor Iselin?
He's gone. Oh, Eleanor, he's gone. A great fighter has gone on to his rest.
The verbatim record must have been set down by Raymond's mother, as she was the only other person present at the senator's death, and she undoubtedly found time to make notes while they waited for the doctor, and while the words were still so fresh in her mind. But Johnny did not use them for almost 3 years, during which time they had undoubtedly been carefully filed for their value as Americana and as a source of inspiration to others. Governor Iselin appointed himself to succeed Senator Vanstoffsen, to fight the good fight, and his re-election followed. He was sworn in on March 18, 1953, by Justice Krushen, after his wife had insisted that he take the cure for 2.5 months at a reliable, discreet, and medically sound ranch for alcoholics and drug addicts in sun-drenched New Mexico, following the booze-drenched Christmas holidays of 1952.